Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everybody. My name is João Durães. I'm a neurologist in the Coimbra Local Health Unit and a member of the EAN Coordinating Panel on Rare Neurological Diseases. In today's episode, we will talk about red flags of treatable cerebellar ataxia. Cerebellar ataxias are a large and heterogeneous group of diseases and a common reason for neurological assessment. They can have acute, subacute, and chronic presentations and frequently lead to a significant impact on the quality of life. Although ataxia is frequently regarded as a main cause of progressive disability, there are several conditions in which a prompt diagnosis and early treatment can stabilize or even improve the symptoms. Due to the clinical heterogeneity of cerebellar ataxias, their diagnosis is often challenging, and a well-organized approach is needed to reach an early diagnosis and avoid missed treatment opportunities. Since this month we celebrate the Rare Disease Day, we will mainly focus on rare causes of ataxia and not cover more common causes like alcohol, infections, or neoplastic diseases. In this episode, we will discuss how to recognize the main rare causes of ataxia in which specific treatments are available. We will highlight the common neurological and systemic red flags that should be assessed during clinical examination, the relevance of a timely and precise diagnostic workup, and the currently available treatments. It is a pleasure to welcome my guests for today, two internationally recognized experts in this field. Our first guest is Professor Paola Giunti, Professor of Neurology at the UCL Queen Square Institute of Neurology in London, and Dr. Lidia Saro, neurologist at the Istituto Neurologico Carlo Vesta in Milan. Professor Giunti, Dr. Saro, welcome to the EAN cast, and thank you very much for joining us today. My first question is to Dr. Saro. One of the main groups neurologists think about when asked about treatable diseases are the immune-mediated disorders. Can you give us an overview on the main diagnosis not to miss, which clinical findings we as neurologists must be aware of, and how can we better guide the diagnostic workup for this group of diseases?
Thank you, thank you for inviting me. So autoimmune-mediated ataxia represent a key area of interest. Those causes account for approximately 6% of sporadic cerebellar ataxia cases in adults. And as you said, age of onset, pre-progression, associated symptoms are the most critical factors to guide the clinical approach and to identify the red flags. Episodic ataxia is the key element. So if not in adulthood, it appears some episodic ataxic attack, an autoimmune etiology is highly likely and should be investigated immediately because it's amenable to therapy. MRI is essentially for narrowing the differential and antibody-mediated demyelinating disease, for example. There is a significant phenotype overlap between different antibodies, and new antibodies are constantly being discovered, so it is a very challenging field of diagnosis. The most frequent autoimmune type of ataxia is the glutamic acid decarboxylase GAD65 antibody-related ataxia. It can present alongside with other GAD-related autoimmune signs such as stiff person spectrum of disorder, pyramidal sign, epilepsy, and also type 1 diabetes, pernicious anemia, and vitiligo and thyroid disease. It is rare, and it typically is diagnosed in women after the 20 years old. There is a limited number of instances where the presence of anti-GAD65 coexists with cancer, but these are limited, like 4 to 6% of cases. Usually, it has a subacute or chronic onset, and gait ataxia is the most prominent feature. Often, patients report warning episodes of vertigo, diplopia, or slurred speech, and the high anti-GAD titers are also linked to stiff person syndrome sometimes. So the key diagnostic element is detecting the antibody The most significant antibody is the one that you can detect in the CSF. Compared to serum, in fact, those are highly specific. You can also find oligoclonal band in the CSF. But the important thing is that titers of these antibodies need to be very high to be diagnostic. In fact, around 2,000 units per ml. Therefore, it is important to collect a paired sample of serum and CSF to get a proper diagnosis and to rule out false positive. Brain imaging can be unremarkable at the beginning, but in later stages, atrophy in the cerebellum can be detected. And it is very important to identify this diagnostic entity because there is a possibility of treatment, not only the symptomatic treatment, but also potentially disease-modifying treatment, which is essentially immunotherapy. First instance, intravenous immunoglobulin or rituximab, or plasmapheresis, which is suggested for short-term adjunct therapy for exacerbation in severe spasm, for example. And also other novel immunotherapies are in the offing, like autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and CAR T cell for severe refractory diseases. Other studies suggest to follow an escalating treatment approach, such as first-line high-dose corticosteroid, and then intravenous immunoglobulin or plasmapheresis, and in the third-line, mycophenolate or rituximab. So the prognosis, usually, if the treatment is started early in the phase, in early phases, there is a good response, but the clinical pearl we need to take home is that always test for anti-GAD in patients who present with ataxia, especially alongside with other autoimmune condition or stiff person syndrome. Another important autoimmune cause we should discuss is the gluten ataxia. In the setting of chronic immune-mediated enteropathy with antibodies against the transglutaminase or endomysium, cerebellar ataxia is the most common neurological manifestations. It can occur together with other symptoms such as neuropathy, brain calcification, seizures, and so on. And it typically presents in the 50s or 60s and is most prevalent in Northern Europe. 90% of persons who present with gluten ataxia might not have gastrointestinal symptoms, even if then biopsy shows a damage. The clinical presentation is a slowly progressive gait and limb ataxia, dysarthria, nystagmus, and associated symptoms such as peripheral neuropathy. Neuropathy and seizures can occur, and chronic malabsorption, such as vitamin deficiency, can worsen the ataxia. Diagnosis is helpful in the diagnosis, the imaging, because cerebellar atrophy can be seen in more than half of the patient, but the gold standard is to detect the antibodies in the blood. And we know that elevated anti-gliadin and transglutaminase type 2 are not always detectable in gluten ataxia, and most sensitive gluten ataxia marker is the transglutaminase type 6 antibodies. But the challenge is that those are not easy to assess. Only few labs can measure them, and this represents a gap that will definitely need to be bridged in the coming years. So given all this, gluten ataxia is nowadays still a controversial entity, difficult to diagnose. Indeed, the diagnosis is often confirmed retrospectively if symptoms stabilize or improve on a strict gluten-free diet. Gluten-free diet and the vitamin supplementation are indeed the first-line treatment, and they can be coupled with the confirmation that of the elimination of antibodies in the blood. But we need to keep in mind that if cerebellar atrophy has already started, the damage is not reversible. And because the nervous system heals slowly compared to the gut, clinicians are advised to wait at least 12 months before labeling a gluten-free diet ineffective and maybe moving to immunosuppression in a more aggressive way of treating the patient. Then after gluten ataxia, I can say that another third important entity is the paraneoplastic cerebellar ataxia, which is a relatively rare disorder, but yet on the most, one of the most frequent paraneoplastic syndromes and very common immune-mediated ataxia. Features are rapidly progressive cerebellar syndrome, and that leads to dysfunction in few months. It is characterized either by an acute or subacute onset, dizziness, vomiting, rapidly progressing over weeks to months into severe pancerebellar syndrome. And 60 to 70% of cases appear before the cancer diagnosis. Common associated malignancies are small lung cancer, breast, gynecological and gastric cancer, and typically, in intracellular antigen autoimmunity, antibodies are biomarkers, but the cytotoxic T cell are believed to be the primary cause of the destruction of the Purkinje cell in the cerebellar cortex. And the most frequent antibodies intracellular that are linked to ataxia are the anti-YO, usually associated to breast and gynecological cancer, anti-TR with associated to Hodgkin disease, anti-U with the small cell lung cancer. And there is also this novel, not yet available in the majority of lab antibody, which is OMER3 antibody, which can give a syndrome that is a very close mimic of MSA type C. It has a limited paraneoplastic link, and it should be mentioned because it can give like the same MRI biomarker of MSAC, so the hot cross bound sign. In general, for paraneoplastic cerebellar ataxia, diagnosis is achieved by detecting the antibody in the blood and or in the CSF. The CSF might show also inflammatory markers, and MRI is often normal at the beginning of the disease, but then rapidly diffuse atrophy comes in. So the goal, the primary treatment, is identifying and treating the underlying tumor. And after that, the second most important thing is to start immunotherapy, classically starting with the steroids or immunoglobulin intravenously, or plasma exchange or cyclophosphamide. Roughly 75 to 80% of patients become non-ambulatory, and the prognosis is not so good anyway. For neuronal surface antigen autoimmunity, antibodies interact directly with the surface, and we can mention, for example, anti-MGLUR1 antibodies or anti-EGLON5 disease, which is a condition that bridges the gap between autoimmunity and neurodegeneration because it is characterized by the antibody interaction and inflammation and leads to tauopathy. Usually it's linked to also a prominent snoring apnea choking in the patient. Other red flags we can include are, for example, if ataxia is preceded by severe diarrhea, you should test for antibody anti-DPPX. And so there is a great clinical overlap, but this is, a glimpse into the paraneoplastic cerebellar ataxia disease spectrum.
Thank you, Dr. Sarro. Your answer was very insightful and highlights that we should carefully assess the type of onset and disease progression, and also be very mindful of the evolution in this field where new antibodies are discovered frequently. Another important group of diseases where an early treatment is particularly relevant are metabolic disorders, which can be acquired or genetic. In this group, there are often other neurological or systemic features that can be helpful red flags to achieve a prompt diagnosis. Professor Giunti, what are the different phenotypes we can find in this group of acquired metabolic disorders?
Thank you, João. Yeah, I would say that the metabolic conditions that lead to ataxia are very complex and multisystemic, as you mentioned. So we have not only neurological symptoms, but also extra-neurological symptoms. I would start as well in dividing the subject in acquired, so secondary and primary cause. these metabolic conditions. So for the secondary cause, I would start with thiamine deficiency, vitamin B1 deficiency, and this can occur in infantile age, called beriberi, and typically from a mother with malnutrition and vitamin B1 deficiency herself, and especially occurs during lactation. What are the presentation of the infant? What are the symptoms that we need to look at? So it typically is a pseudomeningitic symptom with seizures, and also, as you said quite rightly, extra neurological symptoms of cardiac involvement in addition to aphonia. In the young and adult, so we talk about more dry beriberi and wet beriberi, and the dry beriberi is more chronic and is a peripheral neuropathy, so you would expect a sensory ataxia with weakness or reflexia. And then for completeness, we talk about very briefly with wet beriberi that it's more cardiomyopathy with a fetal and edema, and Sochin beriberi that is fulminant fall. But what are the cause in the adults? It's a malnutrition, as I said, and mainly is alcohol use disorders, but also gastroenterological causes like persistent vomiting and iatrogenic causes like bariatric surgery, anorexia nervosa. And also in the Asian population, they habit to use Polish rice as a staple food. So what are the red flags? What is the presentation? So the presentation typically is in a quite acute state. It is the Wernicke one, in which you have the ataxia and ophthalmoplegia and confusion. So the key clinical features are the delusion, hallucination, gated limb ataxias with nystagmus and ophthalmoplegia, but other features can occur like hypotension, hypothermia, and coma. What are the diagnostic elements that we can look for? So elevated lactate and pyruvate, and low blood thiamine, pyrophosphate and transocholatase, and then thyroid function, but also some very important red flag comes with a MRI. And the MRI T2 flare showed a hyperintensity in the thalamus and typically in the mammillary bodies and periaqueductal region in the Wernicke. So we need to bear in mind that this is an emergency treatment, so we do not have to wait for the lab test. If we suspect the Wernicke and get thiamine immediately, parenteral, if suspected, and the thiamine needs to be administered before the glucose, so IV therapy, followed up by oral maintenance. I will move on another vitamin deficiency. This is a vitamin B12 deficiency. Again, this can occur in young patients and also adult patients. And we know that we have aging is predisposed to the vitamin B12. So what are the causes in general? And we need to look for pernicious anemia. And so looking for the anti-intrinsic factors antibodies, a vegan, strict vegetarian diet without supplementation. And again, iatrogenic causes like bariatric surgery, gastrectomy, and also other conditions like Crohn's disease. But very importantly, we need to suspect with a chronic succession of two drugs that are quite common administrative for the condition. They are quite common, metformin and proton pump inhibitors. The other thing that is an emerging as well cause, especially in teenagers and young adults, is the cause of nitrous oxide exposure. So it's a laughing gas. So it's important that one that we have a teenage young adult, we need to really spend a little bit of time in undersect the recreational drug that they're taking, because we know that a nitrous oxide lead to an inactivation of vitamin B12. what is the presentation? Well, that's the red flag. So this is sensory ataxia with peripheral neuropathy and myelopathy. Myelopathy, so it's really important that there is combination of the two with cognitive or psychiatric changes, and the blood test showed low vitamin B12, but can be normal. So we need to as well request the methylmalonic acid and homocysteine and full blood count in looking for macrocytosis, antibodies, anti-intrinsic factors. And again, MRI is helpful, especially MRIs of the spinal cord indicating a posterior column T2 hyperintensities. So the treatment is a replacement, and depending on the severity, obviously, it's oral or parenteral. And this is something that we need to evaluate depending on the onset and the progression. So we move on to vitamin E deficiency, and this is typically in childhood and young adults, and these are due for in the premature babies. Again, malabsorption is one of the culprits, the biliary disease, and reduction in lipid absorption, like we have in abetalipoproteinemia, but also in chronic cholestasis and pancreatic issues, cystic fibrosis, and then Crohn disease. Clinical characteristics are spinocerebellar ataxias and sensory neuropathy, and we have as well the retinal degeneration and cardiomyopathy. Moving on to the genetic causes, so the primary cause of the vitamin deficiency, I will start certainly with vitamin E. This is a recessive inheritance, and this could be caused by, as I said before, a beta-lipoproteinemia due to the gene mutation in the genes MTTP that lead to fat malabsorption, secondary deficiency of vitamins A, D, E, K. And then there is also the primary cause, really primary cause, there is a ataxia with a vitamin E deficiency, AVED, that is due to the genetic mutation in the TTPA genes. What are the neurological features of these conditions? They are the spinocerebellar ataxia, as I said before, with peripheral neuropathy, neuronopathy, and then as well cerebellar involvement with typical nystagmus, but also we have the retinal degeneration. So there is a retinitis pigmentosa, so it's very important to have as well very much in all this condition a proper assessment on the eyes and the retina. So like changes may occur, for example, in TTPA, but also in abetalipoproteinemia. So in addition, we have quite a high number of patients that have fine head tremor with a titubation, with a no-no. This can be a clue, but can be absent. And the other things is as well the presence of cardiomyopathy. So very important to have as well the cardiological assessment. What is the diagnosis? The diagnosis is low vitamin E, so the low lipid adjusted vitamin E, but also the presence of, in the FBC, when we ask for a blood test, acanthocytosis. And this is really important because it can lead as well to the diagnosis of abetalipoproteinemia. For the treatment, we have a high dose of vitamin E from 800 to 1,500 milligrams, but as well, is important that this needs to be adjusted to the patient's needs. So it needs to be monitored. Moving on another genetic cause of the cerebellar ataxia or spinocerebellar ataxia, we're talking about Niemann-Pick type C. This is an autosomal recessive condition and is a lysosomal storage disorder that is due mainly to MPC1 and MPC2. This is most common in childhood, rarely in young adults, and even more rarely in adulthood. The clinical features are the vertical supranuclear gaze palsy, that is kind of a hallmark in adolescent and young adults, and the saccadic palsy. There is as well the cerebellar ataxia, but what as well is characteristics is a cognitive involvement that occurs. So this leads, depending on the age, either learning disability or cognitive decline, and prominent psychiatric symptoms. One thing that is really important, especially in children or young adults, there is a presence of hepatosplenomegaly. So don't be shy to do a medical examination, because that could be really revealing and can give you a clue. There is one thing as well that is important to note. Very rarely has been reported peripheral neuropathy. So this could be a distinguished factor, for example, in other spinocerebellar ataxias. So the other symptoms are dystonia and cataplexy. What is the diagnosis? Is NPC to genetics, bile acid, oxysterol, and on the MRI usually is of limited support and help for the diagnosis of NPC type C, because they show only mild cerebellar atrophy. What is the treatment? The treatment, we have miglustat that has been recognized, and with EMA and MHRA has been approved. Levocetyl-leucine that has been approved by EMA but not by MHRA. And then arimoclomol that has been approved by FDA to be prescribed in association with miglustat. So moving on with the GLUT1 deficiency, it's a very, very rare genetic disorder. This is a autosomal dominant due to SLC2A1 mutation in this gene. Dysfunction is the glucose transporter type 1 and unable to transport the glucose across the brain barrier. The onset can be in infancy to late adults. In children, usually is more prominent the presence of seizures and paroxysmal eye and head movement with developmental delay and cognitive issue, whereas in adults we have a paroxysmal motor disorders like ataxia, dystonia, mild chorea, myoclonus, and this can be associated as well. There are words, obviously, and triggered of this episode is when the patient is fast. How do we diagnose? On the blood test, we see that the glucose is normal, but on the CSF, we have hypoglycorachia with low CSF and serum glucose ratio. And the MRI, unfortunately, brain is not contributory because it can be normal. The treatment is a ketogenic diet. Another condition that is also rare, but is the cerebrotendinous xanthomatosis, and is due to mutation in the C1P27A1 gene. And again, this is can occur in early onset or rarely in adult onset. The key features: chronic childhood diarrhea, juvenile cataract, and when you're juvenile, it's very early. Achilles tendon xanthomas, but the xanthomas can occur as well in other parts of the body, in the elbow and somewhere else. So the neurological characteristic is this progressive ataxia with spasticity, and then the cognitive decline. The blood test showed the elevated cholesterol, and then the genetic test will as well confirm the clinical suspicion. The treatment is with the canodeoxycholic acid. Moving on as well on another rare disease, this is Fabry disease, and this is an X-linked lysosomal disorder with really a truly multisystemic condition. Mutation is the GLA gene, and the features is characterized by sensory ataxia with neuropathic pain, angiokeratomas, and hypohidrosis with gastrointestinal symptoms, renal, cardiac, and we have a cerebrovascular involvement that can then lead to when severe and stroke. What is as well when present, is helpful in the diagnosis is this corneal verticillata or opaque cornea. The diagnosis is done by a blood test that showed low alpha-galactosidase A, and obviously the genetic test as well to confirm the clinical suspicions. The treatment is an enzyme replacement therapies, and also the possibility as well to treat these disorders with migalastat. We move on to Wilson disease, and Wilson disease is due to a mutation in ATP7B. The neurological disorders is very complex. The onset can be early onset for the majority, but also late onset, and it encompasses dystonia, Parkinsonism, tremor, and ataxia. So it's quite challenging as a diagnosis, but also quite relevant psychiatric symptoms. There are liver dysfunction and cystic kidney, and also endocrine systems. So the test is revealed low serotonin, but can be normal, then very relevant to have the 24-hour urinary copper that reveal high copper. Another clue can be with the ophthalmological examination with the slit lamp and the presence of gaze flasher rings due to copper deposition in the detachment membrane. But in this case, the vision is not affected. Again, as a good hallmark in the MRI brain, we have signal changes, and there is the so-called phase of giant panda, and abnormal changes in the midbrain with increased T2 signal. In the treatment, is administration of D-pacinamine, creatine, zinc, and copper-restricted diet. Right, moving on now, CoQ10. And the CoQ10 is a gene that's all involved in CoQ10 pathway. So CoQ10 2, 8A, B, 9, PDSS1, and PDSS2. The red flag is a early onset or late onset, more aggressive, and early onset less aggressive, and sometimes the late onset seems to be resemble MSA type C. So the diagnosis is blood test in muscles or in blood, a test in muscle and blood with low CoQ10, and the genetic test for genes involved in the pathway. The treatment is CoQ10 supplementation. And we have the, as a secondary CoQ10 deficiency, is the presence as well of CoQ10 deficiency in the AO1 and AO2. There seems to be interfering in the pathway of this CoQ10. And the NO1 and the SCAR10 as well has been linked with CoQ10 deficiency. The diagnosis is, as I said, with the muscles, level of CoQ10, or in blood as well, cells with level of CoQ10, but genetic testing should then support the clinical suspicions. And the treatment is a high dose of CoQ10. Moving on the other multisystemic condition, this is a peroxisomal disorder. Are we talking about Revson disease? And this is due to the PHYH gene mutations that leads to accumulation of phytanic acid, and the presentation is a sensory ataxia with retinitis pigmentosa and neuropathy, with the diagnosis have the plasma, the low the plasma phytanic acid, and the treatment is a phytanic acid free diet and sometimes plasma pheresis. Thank you, Joao.
Thank you, Professor Giunti, for organizing so well this dense topic. Indeed, careful past medical history assessment, brain imaging, and use of biochemical studies, namely metabolite assessment or enzymatic activity assays, can be really helpful for this group of diseases. Also related to this topic, I would like to invite the listeners to look for a recent EANcast episode on the topic of treatable mitochondrial disorders, a group of diseases who can often present with cerebellar ataxia. And now we move to an often overlooked topic when talking about treatable ataxias, the other genetic causes. We will focus on diseases with specific treatments, although they are mainly symptomatic and not proven to be disease-modifying. Friedreich's ataxia is a prime example of recent therapeutic advancements. Dr. Saro, why is an early diagnosis of Friedreich's ataxia particularly important at this time?
Thank you, John, for asking. Friedreich's ataxia is indeed one of the most common hereditary ataxia, the most common recessive ataxia. And since 2024, EMA approved a therapy, which is called omaveloxolone, with disease-modifying potential. This is why we need to recognize Friedreich's ataxia. Usually, it begins in adolescence, though it can range from 2 to over 70 year, the start of this disease. GAA expansion in the frataxin gene coding for a protein which is a mitochondrial protein essential for iron sulfur cluster biogenesis and also as an antioxidant regulatory functions. So a deficiency in frataxin, how it happens in Friedreich's ataxia, leads to a mitochondrial iron accumulation causing oxidative stress and cellular injury. And this primarily affects tissues with high energy demands such as the brain, the heart, and the pancreas. So it is And this is where the new first approved therapy fits, since omaveloxolone has a mechanism of action that is primarily antioxidant. In fact, it activates the NRF2, which is an antioxidant agent, and also inhibits other pro-inflammatory factors. We need to recognize Friedreich's ataxia, and the clinical red flags are a progressive loss of coordination, a significant impairment of proprioception and vibratory sense, loss of deep tendon reflexes, dysarthria, dysphagia, and vision loss, and hearing loss in later stages. And is also was often coupled by a systemic involvement, which can be first hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is present also in about 85% of patients, and also scoliosis, foot deformities, pes cavus. Diabetes occurs in 30% of patients, and the MRI can help in terms that it shows atrophy of the spinal cord and medulla, while cerebellum is often spared in early stages. Electromyography tests reveal axonal sensory neuropathy, and in this case, we should suspect and ask for a genetic testing for Friedreich's ataxia. The first approved therapy is this, as we said before, is omaveloxolone. It has been approved in February 2023 by FDA, and then EMA approved it in February 2024 for patients with Friedreich's ataxia, which are older than 16 years. A trial targeted to prove safety and efficacy in younger patients is ongoing. And the original trial that made the drug approval possible was the MOXIE trial, in which patients were scored with the modified Friedreich's ataxia rated score, which is called MFARS. And the results proved that the treatment led to a minus 2.4 difference in MFARS score compared to placebo over 48 weeks. And also a long-term extension data suggests that benefits is preserved over time, hinting that the drug may be slowing the underlying disease progression rather than just masking symptoms. So the dosing is 150 milligrams once daily on empty stomach. The common side effects are elevated liver enzymes that we need to test, so ALT, AST, bilirubin monthly for the first 3 months, and also other common side effects are headache, nausea, and diarrhea, but still is a well-tolerated drug. So the clinical pearl here with the Friedreich's ataxia is that omaveloxolone represent a historic milestone for the treatment of such ataxia, and its value lies in the potential to change the long-term trajectory of the disease, and therefore Friedreich is a diagnosis not to miss.
Thank you, Dr. Sailoff, for this timely update on this topic. Although discussions regarding reimbursement of ampreloxetine in different countries are still ongoing, an early diagnosis is always important in this condition. Another interesting topic is the use of repurposed drugs with interesting results in diseases like SCA27B and episodic ataxias. Professor Giunti, would you like to elaborate on this topic?
Yeah, thank you. I think these are a group of drugs that has been a trial, and anecdotally, they improve symptoms. So again, symptomatic for this condition. So the first two are the episodic ataxias. One is episodic ataxia type 1 with an onset in childhood or adolescence, and the episodes are characteristically brief, seconds or minutes attacks, and they can have as well the features that is myoclonia, neuromyotonia, muscle spasm, and obviously ataxias. And the diagnosis is made genetically with identifying mutations in the KCNA1. The treatment is acetazolamide, or can be as well carbamazepine, phenytoin, or lamotrigine. And another episodic ataxia is episodic ataxia type 2, that is onset in childhood, adolescence, rarely in adulthood. These are also paroxysmal episodes of ataxia that are much more prolonged, and typically interictally, patient has a downward nystagmus. They are often associated as well with migraine. They can as well be like familial hemiplegic migraine. And this has as well the characteristic to become progressive. The diagnosis is genetic, as in the mutation in the CAGNA1A, and the treatment is again acetazolamide. There are some reports on 4-aminopyridine, but as well some report with flunarizine. Another emerging cause and disease is the spinocerebellar ataxia 27B that has been reported, and this is a very much part of the expansion disorders because the mutation is a GAA expansion, like Friedreich ataxia, for example, but in FGF14. So there is typically a late onset. It's a rather pure cerebellar ataxia with, again, downward nystagmus, but without a derailed VOR. And there is the presence of episodic symptoms either before or after the onset of the progressive ataxia. And the treatment seems to be responding. This patient is a 4-aminopyridine.
Thank you for your answer, Professor Giunti. So to summarize the key points of this episode, although individually rare, the causes of ataxia we discussed do appear on our clinical practice, and their timely recognition is essential. Therefore, every neurologist should try to incorporate the practical checklist of warning signs into the diagnostic approach to avoid missed treatment opportunities. In autoimmune-mediated diseases, we should be really alert to the type of presentation, particularly in acute or episodic symptoms, and we should also be careful on the diagnostic workup, namely with fluid biomarkers, including the variety of antibodies Dr. Saro mentioned. This autoimmune group of conditions is an evolving field, so look out for new emerging ones, as these conditions could be treatable. In the acquired metabolic diseases, a careful risk factor assessment is critical when there is a clinical suspicion. In this group of diseases, simple blood tests and, in some cases, MRI imaging can provide important clues for the diagnosis. Regarding the genetic metabolic disorders, biochemical tests in the blood or other tissues are still very relevant for our routine clinical practice, particularly in settings when genetic testing is not easily accessible. Professor Giunti mentioned before a detailed list of blood tests that are relevant in identifying rare metabolic diseases that should be requested, especially in familial or idiopathic cerebellar ataxia. The clinical picture and the other fluid or imaging biomarkers could also be relevant to establish the diagnosis when we find a variable of unknown significance in an NGS test. For other genetic causes, we should always be careful in requesting the genetic tests and remember to specifically look for repeat expansion diseases like Friedreich's ataxia and SCAT27B, who usually do not appear on standard NGS panels. I would like to thank our guests for their valuable insights and for helping us to organize this complex topic, and also to our listeners. Thank you for joining us on EANcast, Weekly Neurology. We hope this episode will help neurologists to be alert to the often hidden red flags for treatable cerebellar ataxias. Until next time, goodbye, and thank you for listening.
This has been EANcast, Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.